I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia, and we are covering two court cases on the show today. This past Monday, U.S. District Judge Wendy Beadlestone in Philadelphia ruled against the Trump administration's plan to roll back the birth control mandate under the Affordable Care Act. This challenge to the administration was brought by the Pennsylvania and New Jersey attorneys general. The Department of Health and Human Services wanted to give large private companies, along with religious nonprofits, the right to refuse to cover contraception because of religious or moral objections. Her ruling puts a temporary halt to the new regulation that was actually set to go into effect on Monday and comes on the heels of a similar ruling in California. We asked Allison Hoffman to tell us what the court ruling means, what the Trump administration wanted to do, what is meant by religious and moral objections, and what happens next. She's an expert on healthcare law and policy, also a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and a senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics. She's currently a visiting professor of law at Yale Law School, joining us from their studios. Allison Hoffman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be here.
What was the case before federal judge Wendy Beadlestone?
So the case was a challenge to some Trump regulations that would have created an exemption to the contraception mandate under the ACA. And the question that Judge Beadlestone addressed this week was whether to issue a preliminary injunction, so whether to put a hold on these regulations while determining whether they are legal or not. And her answer to that question was yes, that it looks plausible that the challengers to these regulations will win on the merits and that they would be harmed in the process if these rules were rolled out now. So for now, what Judge Beadlestone has said is that we're going to wait, that the administration has to wait on rolling out these regulations until we reach a decision on the merits of them.
Let me pick up on a couple of things. It looks like the Trump administration wanted to expand this exemption for contraception coverage to beyond religious nonprofits or even privately held companies, but to publicly held companies. Tease that out for us.
Yeah, so what the rule proposed doing was creating two new categories of exemptions to the ACA requirement. And just to take a step backwards, what the ACA required in the Women's Health Amendment was it required health plans broadly, so in health plans for individuals and group health plans, so those health plans that come through employers unless they were grandfathered, so that carved out a small number. But most health plans had to cover preventive care without cost sharing. And that included women's preventive care as provided in guidelines that were supported by the Health Resources and Services Administration. HRSA is a health and human services agency. So HRSA said that when we talk about women's preventive care, that includes all forms of contraception approved by the FDA. And so that's been a controversial requirement since HRSA put out that regulation. And so now what the Trump administration has tried to do through these two regulations is to allow broad leeway for organizations, for for-profit corporations to opt out of this requirement. And there are two pieces to the regulations they put out. The first one was just a broadening of religious objections to the mandate, so to allow all for-profit corporations, churches, nonprofit and other organizations, higher education, to say we have religious objections to this mandate, and if they had such religious objections, to be exempted from it altogether. And so the most significant change there is that it extends this kind of exemption possibility to for-profit corporations, which hadn't been contemplated, to even publicly traded for-profit corporations, which had not been the law before. And then the second piece is even broader than that, and it's saying that that if an organization has a moral objection, that they can also be exempted from and not have to comply with the mandate.
Well, let me pick up on both of those things. In fact, let me just give out the phone number to our listeners. If they want to join our conversation, I invite them to do so. It's 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Well, how does the law, and I realize that there is this Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993, but how does the law look at a moral objection? I mean, how do you find the legal language that would define what that is?
It's really unclear. It's extremely fuzzy. So there will be more kind of debate and controversy over the question of religious objections and how far those should go and how many organizations under the existing law should be exempted, because there are laws out there like the Free Exercise Clause and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, known as RFRA, which do protect religious exercise. The notion that an organization could have a moral objection and that there would be protection of that under the law is really uncharted territory. And a lot of people think it's really implausible to imagine that something like this would be, would be kind of legally justiciable, would be enforceable, that you could create meaningful boundaries to what is a moral objection, what is not a moral objection. So there aren't really clear protections under the law for that. And there aren't clear delineations under the guidelines on what exactly that would mean.
Well, and I'm even thinking of, let's take a Fortune 500 company. Mm-hmm. That is different from a religious institution, at least it seems to me. How does a Fortune 500 company that has no, their business is not about religion, how do they get a religious exemption? I'm struggling here with – yes. I'm not a lawyer, clearly. But go ahead, Allison.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really good question. And we haven't seen it happen. So, I can't tell you exactly how that would happen, whether it would be a vote of shareholders, whether it would be a board decision. But at least what the regulations do is it creates the potential of that. And so the closest we had gotten to this was in the Hobby Lobby challenge, where we had a closely held for-profit organization where, you know, the family owners of the company had religious – said that they had – that it was a violation of their religious beliefs to provide contraceptive coverage to their employees. And there you can imagine in a closely held corporation that
right.
there are people whose views might be aligned with the company. But it's really hard to imagine exactly how that would play out for a publicly traded large corporation.
Is there any evidence that large corporations want to get out from under this regulation?
I have not seen any. That doesn't mean that there isn't any. I mean, I think there have been some objections from leaders in large corporations, but whether any of them would actually try to act on that is difficult to know.
Now, this judge in Philadelphia, her preliminary injunction really applies to the whole country, which is interesting because the one in California that was on Sunday, this was on Monday, applied to only a certain part of the country. This is a very legal question for you, but
yeah,
how come? I mean, what's the difference there?
Well, so her justification in the case is that this is not a workable injunction unless it applies to all the states. And so the two states involved in the Pennsylvania case are Pennsylvania and New Jersey. And her point is that Pennsylvania and New Jersey, people who if we stop the regulations in these states but not in neighboring states,
right.
So in neighboring states organizations can go ahead and follow through on these exemptions, it's going to be meaningless in application because people travel across state lines. People live in neighboring states. They live in New York and they work in New Jersey. And people get their health care across state lines. So her reasoning is that, you can't actually have a meaningful injunction unless it applies broadly because of the way that people operate with regard to employment, with regard to health care, which isn't confined to the boundaries of the states. She wasn't – she didn't have – limitations in the same way that Judge Gilliam did in California, because in previous litigation on this issue in California, Judge Gilliam had also placed a nationwide injunction on the earlier regulations on this issue, and that was appealed up to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit pushed back on the breadth of that injunction and said that the injunction was substantively acceptable, but that it could only apply to the states that were litigants in the case. And so the Ninth Circuit limited the bounds. So when he issued an injunction that only applied to the states who were litigants in the case, which now are 13 states in that piece of litigation, he was complying with kind of restrictions that were placed on him from above.
We're talking about a federal judge in Philadelphia on Monday essentially stopping the Trump administration's new rule that would have expanded the employer exemptions for covering contraception on both religious and or moral grounds. And again, Allison Hoffman, she's a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, is explaining the significance of the ruling. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Allison, let me also go a little bit deeper into what the judge said. She said that this ruling could result in unplanned pregnancies. She also said that she felt as if as many as 125,000 women would not be able to, have this no-cost birth control, and seemed to think that the states would be harmed by this because they'd have to pick up the tab for these costs. Can you dig deeper into what she was saying?
Yes, and what she's saying comes directly from the administration's regulations. So this is language in the regulations where the administration estimates what might be the impact of the regulations. And so the administration estimated that as many as 126,000 women might be affected. Their employers might drop coverage. And what might happen then is that they would go to some number of them would go to Title X, to free clinics to be able to get access to contraception. And those clinics are funded in part by the states. And so the estimated expense was $63.7 million in the regulations, and the states would be picking up a share of that expense. So it essentially would be shifting the cost of contraception from the employers and the employee health plans onto the states, who would be then funding the employees that the employers carved out of their plans.
Let me read a couple of comments. Anne Marie comments. She says, perhaps this is the perfect segue to open a discussion about disentangling health insurance from employment altogether, as is the norm in much of the rest of the world. We actually did a show not so long ago about health care for all, or Medicare for all. Kate from Salem writes, I'm curious about religious objections to people using birth control for medical reasons. I'm on birth control for 3 different hormonal disorders, not to prevent pregnancy. If my birth control was not covered by insurance, I could not afford to take it and would be in constant pain. Would the court recognize that, or how does the Affordable Care Act recognize that?
Well, the Affordable Care Act recognizes it by covering it. So when HRSA decided what women's health would include, it said all forms of contraception approved by the FDA. And why is that included? Because it's central to women's health. And the discussions that led up to that regulation talked about all these kinds of health purposes of why women use contraception, in addition to timing or preventing pregnancies, and also on how important contraception is for women in terms of investing in their careers and education to be able to have control over their family planning, over the timing of when they have children. So these kinds of considerations went deeply into the initial regulations to require covering contraception. Now, how they play out in the legal challenges is more of a question mark. So if you look at the first case, Hobby Lobby, where Hobby Lobby and other closely held for-profit organizations said this is a violation of our religious freedom, and the court said yes, it is. And Judge Ginsburg wrote a really strong dissenting opinion that said that once religious freedom and once religious views are pushing up against things like anti-discrimination principles and equal protection of women, they're not unbounded. There has to be a point at which kind of religious views are not all encompassing. And so that's underlying these questions is how do you wrestle with these kinds of concerns where women's health and women's careers and advancement are necessitated, are strongly helped by having access to good medical care and health care. And so where does that come into the equation? That's one of the legal issues that will be teased out in the coming year.
Sure. Let me quote from the Trump administration, Health and Human Services, that said, no American should be forced to violate his or her own conscience in order to abide by the laws and regulations governing our health care system. And I'm trying to imagine, applying that broadly, there are people who object to our military budget. It seems like this just opens a giant can of worms.
Right. It absolutely does. And that was a talk after, the Hobby Lobby cases. Where's the end of this? You can imagine all kinds of religious groups objecting to all different kinds of coverage and insurance plans. And, at what point are there other considerations that come into play that say, these other values are important TAR society as well.
I mean, it seems that birth control contraception is still considered a very controversial issue, but I wonder if this is also part of an effort to chip away at the Affordable Care Act, whether it has to do with the mandate or pre-existing conditions, and now we're talking about birth control.
I think it is part of the larger trend of chipping away at the ACA. And, you know, one of the pieces that, Marty, that really amazes me about this particular controversy is that birth control, if you look at the larger population views, is not all that controversial of an issue. You know, 90% of respondents in a recent Gallup poll were in support of women having access to contraception. 86% of Catholics. So if you imagine subgroups who might be opposed, even among those, kind of the population, the people at large, are largely in support of women having access to contraception. So part of, when I watched this debate happening, part of my interpretation of it is that it's really kind of not in line with where the larger public is on these views. But it is part, as you mentioned, of kind of a larger chipping away at the requirements that the ACA put in place for insurance plans. And so it does fit into that larger story.
Well, and this, I mean, I guess we need to say this, certainly contraception reduces the number of unwanted pregnancies. I mean,
right.
No surprise there, right?
Right, absolutely.
So do you see this going to the U.S. Supreme Court? Where do you see there are two cases, but the one we've been focusing on is the one here in Philadelphia. Where do you see this going next?
I think this will work its way back up to the Supreme Court. I mean, it will – the same way that before the Trump administration issued these new regulations, this issue was working its way through the court in various forms. So it wasn't resolved even under the Obama administration regulations, where the status of it was at that point was still had a lot of question marks and would have eventually reached the Supreme Court again. And so I think we'll see this issue likewise work its way up through the courts and likely eventually reach the Supreme Court as well, as long as it's not disrupted by another regulatory move before it gets there.
So it's in place until whatever the next higher court or the Supreme Court makes its decision?
It's in place, but right now it's not because of Judge Beadlestone's opinion. It's not. There's an injunction on enforcement. So I think we'll see appeals on both those injunctions that have paused the enforcement of the law, and then we'll have to see the case decided on its merits. So the two judges who have decided so far have only looked at this preliminary question of whether the administration can enforce these regulations right now. They haven't made their final decision on the actual substantive merits of the case. So there's still a long way between where the courts are now and an eventual appeal up through the circuits into the Supreme Court.
Well, Allison Hoffman, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times, walking us through this very important but complicated legal thicket. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And she's an expert on healthcare law and policy, a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. She's a senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics, which is here in Philadelphia at the Wharton School. Currently a visiting professor of law at Yale Law School, joining us from the Yale University studios. We're going to really shift gears after this very short break, talking about Roosevelt Boulevard here in Philadelphia and why it is so dangerous. Stay with us. We'll be right back.